So Karen spoiled my joke already. Sorry. Anyway, I was asked by the TMGC members to give the council an overview of how the U.S.-Canada shares are determined. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time on how the NIMS and DFO surveys are used in calculating those shares. And so I'm going to try and build us a tower here, and hopefully at the end of the presentation it's not going to fall over like the game Jenga. So there we go. Word of the day for those keeping score. That's not it. Okay. So I think it's important to remember that we calculate the shares based on a negotiation that took place with the Canadians back in the late 90s. And I think it's important to note that neither country got exactly what they wanted when we negotiated the sharing agreement. For example, the Canadians initially, when they walked in the room, they didn't want to consider anything that happened before the ruling on the U.S.-Canada boundary, basically nothing before 1985. And they wanted to downweight resource use because they said the U.S. has not been under a hard quota from the period 85 on, whereas we have been, so you shouldn't get credit for overfishing the stock. So this was their initial position on how to do things. And I think we also have to remember that a lot of the U.S. landing history was generated on the side of the line that we no longer have access to, on the eastern side of the line. I took sort of a very quick look, for example, during the period 83-84, just before the Hague Line decision. And I think somewhere around 20 or 30% of our yellowtail flounder catch was coming from the part of the ocean that we no longer have access to, for Georges Bank yellowtail flounder. The U.S., on the other hand, when we walked in the room, we wanted to consider the landings history over the entire time series, and by entire time series, we went back into the 60s is what I mean by that. And I think the U.S. also wanted to take into account that for much of that period, we were the ones who invested in the research on the bank. Our resource surveys took place, as you all know, through the 60s and 70s, and I don't think the Canadians actually started surveying the bank until around 85 or 86. So we felt that that's what should be taken into advantage. Now, these were initial negotiating positions when we walked in the room, and they, of course, were modified. And eventually, we reached an agreement. And the agreement was that we would consider two factors for the resource shares. They were weighted factors. One would be resource utilization, and this is a historic utilization. It's a fixed period. I think the years were 1967 to 1994, but it might have been 64 to 94. I should double-check that. And then the second point was resource distribution as determined by surveys. When we started with the agreement, we created a table that said the catch part, the resource utilization part, would be weighted one way and the surveys weighted another. And over time, that weighting shifted from the catch, the resource utilization, to the survey. We're at the end of that cycle, and so now 90% of the decision is based on the resource distribution and 10% of it is based on the resource use. Now, let me catch up to my notes, make sure we're all right here. Now, one of the reasons why the U.S. agreed to this was the underlying belief that as the stocks rebuilt, the resource would be distributed more evenly across the bank. And so we would benefit from rebuilding the stocks. Our resource share would go up, and the resource distribution would go up over time. And this seems to have been borne out for Georges Bank Haddock, which you'll see in a minute, which is the only one of the stocks that has actually rebuilt considerably over the time period. So the question came up at the Georges Bank Yellowtail Working Group and in a couple other places about how are the surveys actually used. So I thought I'd go into that a little bit. We use all of the NIMS and Canadian surveys. We have a spring and fall. They have a, quote, spring, which takes place in February, which sure as heck isn't spring in New Hampshire, so it can't be spring in Canada. And we treat the surveys slightly differently. For Georges Bank Cod, we average the U.S. and Canadian spring surveys, and then we average that with a fall survey, whereas for the Yellowtail and Haddock, we average all three of them together. So this raw average is then smoothed with what's caused a low S smoother. And it's kind of important to note that there's a little bit of a lag here. We use the surveys, for example, in 2011 to contribute to what the share is going to be in 2013. So there's a little bit of a lag. So most of us in here really aren't familiar with what a low S smoother is. It's a locally weighted polynomial regression, which clears things right up, I think. Basically, what you're doing is you're taking each point of the survey and you're picking a neighborhood around that survey, meaning the points on either side, and you're fitting a regression to those points in the survey. And so you've got a lot of decisions to make. One is, how big is that window? And that's referred to a lot of different names. You'll see it called tension, span, window, nearest neighbor, whatever. But this, how wide that window is, can influence the result. But there's another element of low-S smoothers that builds into this, and that is that the smoother we use is called a robust smoother, and what that means is that it tends to downweight outliers that are in that window. And you'll see how this has an effect in a minute. But first, to show you the influence of span, oops, shifting the wrong button. This is, I think, George's yellowtail, and it's just three examples of how the smoother, which is the line, looks different depending what size of span or window or tension, whatever you want to call it, that is used here. And so what we're using at the track and the TMGC is this span of 0.3, which you can see goes down at the end. Well, if you used a span of 0.2, it reacts more quickly and it would go up. And if you used a span of 0.4, you know, the line starts to look almost straight as it goes through all the data. The choice of the span was agreed to and is part of the agreement and was built into the understanding. So that's not something we can readily change at this point. So it's worth a legitimate question, I guess, is how has the smoother affected the U.S.? I keep hitting the button. Sorry. So this is what we've got for Georges Bank Cod, and you're going to see three of these. The blue line is basically the results of averaging the surveys. The red line is when you put the smoother through here. I'm only looking at through 2001 through 2011, which is why it doesn't look very smooth, to be honest with you. If we stretch this out over 30 years, it wouldn't look quite so ragged. But as you might expect, sometimes the smoother tends to make the survey average higher than it is in any given year when you apply the smoother, and sometimes it's lower. If you look at the circles, these are all the points where it was higher than it was in any given year. Now, we've only been using this in U.S. management since 2004, so those are really the only circles you want to look at. This is what it looks like for Eastern Georges Bank Cod. This is what it looks like for Eastern Georges Bank Haddock. Now, this is, I think, perhaps what we sort of was hoping would happen of every stock. As the stock rebuilt, you can see that the survey indices started to go up, and they did go up from 2001, where the distribution was about 10%, to 2009, where it looks like it peaked out up at around 41 or 42%. And it's dropped off a little bit, which, you know, people won't like this, but the fact is the stock is declining a little bit, and we're seeing the distribution go down a little bit. Maybe that's just a coincidence, but this is sort of a thought process that we had that might take place. If you look at Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder, this is how it impacts. Now, you can see the points here, and this is what, of course, attracted a lot of attention to everybody at the Georges Yellowtail Working Group. You notice that the survey, which is pretty erratic in the last few years, we had some real low points in here in some of the surveys, and then we've got a real high points in here where the survey jumps up to, I think, 87% or something like that. And yet, when you apply the smoother, you say, what's going on here? The smoother actually goes down. And this is a result of what the low-S smoother does with downweighting the survey points. And I'm going to show you, I think, example to illustrate this. If you look on the left, this is not quite the smoother we use, but it's close enough for this graph. Circles are the data points, the raw average of the three surveys. The line is the low-S smoother. 86% is where we were in 2011, and you can see that, you know, it goes down a little bit. And so you get this somewhat counterintuitive result where if you imagine that in 2011, that we only had 65% on our side of the line, well, son of a gun, our share would have been up closer to, not our share, the smoother would have gone up closer to about 50%. It's like 48 or somewhere in there. And this is because it's not as much of an outlier, and so the LOAS smoother doesn't downweight it as much. So this is what I mean by saying LOAS has a downweighting in it, and this influences us. So if we go back to what it actually looks like, this is where we're at. And so, you know, the conclusion with the smoother, sometimes it works in your favor, sometimes it doesn't. This, you talk about coincidences, this is a pretty big one. Since 2004, there have been 24 U.S.-Canada quotas set. The smooths, if you take all those into account, if you counted up the circles while I was going through them, the smooth survey was higher than the raw survey in exactly 12 instances. So, you know, half the time it worked in our favor, half the time it didn't, which is a good result, perhaps just strictly a coincidence because of the year we did this, but it shows that you really don't have any bias that's resulting as a result of the survey. So what might happen next year? I mean, it's hard to say. If the raw survey average is above roughly 50% in 2012, we would expect that the smoother would go up, start to go up, and the higher above it was, the more it would go up. If the raw average is somewhere between 40 to 45%, which we've seen, I guess, once, which is in 2008, then the smoother might decline a little bit. And those are ballpark numbers. Don't take any of those to the bank. So ultimately, when you put all this stuff together, this is the end result. Once you combine the smooth survey average and you combine the historic catch, which now accounts for only 10% of the survey distribution, this is what you see what's happened. You can see that in the case of Georges Bank Haddock, the increase in the distribution has outweighed the decline in the weighting of the landings history over time, and we've seen a gradual increase of our share of Eastern Georges Bank Haddock, at least up till 2012, and then in the last year we've seen a slight decline. On the other hand, if you look at Georges Bank Yellowtail, you can see that it was staying between 70 to 80% till about 2009, and then we've seen a big drop since about 2009 and down to this year's percentage. If you look at Eastern Georges Bank Cod, you know, we had a slight increase going maybe up until 2009, and then it appears that we've got a slide in our share down to about 2013. The historic shares are also shown up there in parentheses, and that's basically the landings history over that time period that I talked about. You can see that, generally speaking, Haddock is close to our historic share on Eastern Georges Bank Haddock, and the other two stocks are really not close to what our historic catch share has been since then. So that covers the overview of how the shares are distributed.
Questions for Tom? Mark?
Yeah, you said that the initial step of evaluating the information is averaging the surveys. What actually gets averaged? Is it that the raw, you know, kilograms per tow, or is there some biomass swept expansion does? How do they get brought into comparability before there's a, you know, an averaging process?
We use the surveys and converted to swept area biomass, and then the swept area biomass on each side of the line is, you know, determines the proportion in each survey, and then that's what's averaged. There were some questions raised. There's often questions raised about the Bigelow. First off, are you using a big calibration on the Bigelow? The answer is, and Chris will jump up if I get this wrong, the answer is no. We're just you don't need to do a calibration because it's all the calculations are done within a year for the swept area biomass. There was also an issue that the track explored with respect to, you know, is this really working if the size distributions are different on either side of the line? And an exploration of that a few years ago found that the surveys are essentially catching the same sized fish, so there doesn't seem to be a problem with differential sizes on either side of the line.
I'm sure we're probably not using the same net, but do we use the same sweep?
I don't know. I don't know that it matters if we're using the same sweep. The I suspect we're not using the exact same sweep. It's a relative biomass index on either side of the line within a survey that's used. We're not necessarily comparing one survey to the other.
Well, if we're determining percentages based on the survey, we could game the system by going out there with a flounder sweep and radically increasing our yellowtail catch in the survey.
No, we wouldn't, because what happens is, just as a simple example, made up example, if one survey were to catch 100 fish total and caught 50 of them on one side and 50 on the other side, the proportions would be 50% in that survey. If the next survey went out and caught only 50 fish, but caught 25 on one side and 25 on the other, its conclusion would be that one caught 50% on each side of the line. And so, you know, they would be saying the exact same thing in that case, even though one survey caught twice as many fish as the other survey. Now, if they were to somehow, for some reason, that would result in different catches on different sides of the line, I guess that's possible, but that it might have an influence between them. But even then, I'm not sure it would, because you're doing that proportion calculation within each survey.
Okay, if we're both surveying each other's waters, that's what I didn't take into account. I thought we were just surveying our waters and they were surveying their waters.
No, we survey, both surveys survey both sides of the line. And so both surveys come up with a proportion on each side of the line.
So basically it's a check on each other.
Yes.
Okay.
John Bullard.
Tom, thanks for this summary. I just want to link this discussion to something we were talking about yesterday when I was reporting on topics that were brought up during the listening session when people, and Rick, you weren't here for that, but people were talking about how fish populations are moving due to changes in water temperature or anything else like that, and how if fish populations are moving northward and that movement is accelerating, that if you talk about basing state allocations on historical catches, we might have to think about different ways of doing that. And so here Tom has described a way that two countries have tried to resolve that by setting up a system that used the equivalent of historical catches and over a period of time moved from historical catches to distribution. And NRCC is going to meet at some point in the future. And we also, from state to state, are going to look at the issue of stocks moving. And we may also have to think about, you know, will we have to think about ways to deal with stocks moving? And how might we? Here's a lesson in a formula. Maybe it's a good lesson. Maybe it's not a lesson. But, you know, it's one way to deal with a situation.
David Pierce.
Yeah, Tom, do you know if there are any criteria or any conditions in the understanding that would actually trigger a reconsideration of the terms of the understanding? In other words, does it go on forever, or does something happen, something specified in the understanding that would bring us back to the table to take a look at the way things are and maybe the way things need to be in the future?
Well, I'm not aware of anything in the understanding that automatically generates a review of any of the understanding's provisions. You know, between the Transboundary Management Guidance Committee and the Steering Committee, which is sort of the supervisory body over that, I think they can choose to, but I don't believe there's anything in the understanding that says, you know, we'll review this stuff every 5 years, every 10 years, or whenever.
So that would mean then that John and his counterpart in Canada would have to decide to discuss the issue, and of course John would have to offer up some compelling reasons why it's a good idea to talk some more, and consider such things as the issue that John just raised, the shifting populations, environmental conditions. So that's I guess, the only avenue that could be used to revisit the understanding. It's my assumption.
If you would like.
Yeah, I think the argument we want more fish would probably not be the compelling reason. So it set up a 10-year phase-in, but there is no trigger to reevaluate. It just goes on until someone says there's a reason that it doesn't work. But there's no automatic trigger to.
I think it's also, thank you, Mr. Chairman, I think it's also important to point out that fisheries management is at a ministerial level in Canada, if I understand correctly. And so it would be more complicated than you sitting down with your counterpart. This would have to probably go through state.
Anyone else for Tom? Drew?
Drew Minkiewicz, Fisheries Survival Fund. Sorry, but I'm sitting here wondering, where's the urgency? We are talking about, in the case of Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder, a stock we've historically caught 98%. The current catch trends are still in that range of us catching well over 90%. Yet we're in an agreement where we're getting 44%. And then we're talking about taking away a directed fishery that's supported the Port of New Bedford. And we're talking about seriously restraining our most profitable fishery. Yet we're talking, where is the urgency? Why are we not talking about how 44% of something we catch over 90% of is not acceptable? Are we just going to sit and that's it? That's fine? That's all we do? I mean, we're also sitting here in the audience listening to, I don't understand why there's an emergency when there's $160 million being lost to the economy. Is that the position of the administration? $160 million isn't an emergency? Where is the urgency? There are real problems here. Can we please talk about some possible solutions? I'm sorry, we're just getting a little frustrated looking at this. We catch over 90% of the yellowtail. Always have, still are. We're getting 44%. That's not acceptable. We're looking to shut down fisheries. And here we are. We can give ourselves some relief. The Canadians only use yellowtail as bycatch. They only need around 200 metric tons or less. Yet we're giving them more that they're not going to use. Why? Why are we not talking about ways that we can possibly do something about this?
Drew, the fact is that we have started talking with the Canadians about that. You were there. You listened to it. We approached the idea of looking at the agreement. Did not get a very positive response out of it. That got elevated to the steering committee. There are parts of it that will likely be looked at in the intersessional, not all of it, and may not come out the way we would want it. But secondarily, we are talking about the trading issue with them. That is one of the items that is on the intersessional thing. So, I mean, we have started the discussions with them. If you know, and I understand the frustration, but you know, the response and how these things normally go just isn't going to go as fast as we need it to go, but it is at least moving. Anyone else?
Mary Beth.
Let's do finish up with the audience. Back to the council, Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a couple of questions about that. And I was trying to recall the date that they were polling for this intersessional meeting. And the reason I ask that is if we weren't able to actually come up with some agreement to trade, for example, do we have a process in place here that would allow us to then come back and implement that trade in 2013? So that's kind of a little bit of a process thing. And then as far as one note that I took, as Loretta was giving her presentation, was this, the TMGC adopted a strategy to maintain a low to neutral risk of exceeding the fishing mortality limit reference, which is often referred to the FREF, as a strategy. And, of course, we discussed this at the meeting. And yet, I was frustrated, as I think people knew, because we had received advice from our SSC that was different. And the interpretation seemed to be we were very bound by this portion of the strategy to go in this direction versus the flexibility that the SSC provided us. So is this part of the agreement, and could this be discussed at our intersessional? Is one part, and then any decision we might make at the intersessional, do we have the ability to then come back here in the U.S. and implement it in the next fishing year?
It would have to come back and be approved by the council if we came up with some sort of trading scheme. Okay, it would have to come back and be approved by the council. I'm going to have to ask Gene or George to help me with how if the council approves it and we wanted to go ahead with something, how would that be implemented, through an amendment or would it framework, or is there, since it's an international agreement, is there some other mechanism for us to get something in place?
I don't think so. You'd have to do it within the parameters of the groundfish fishery management plan. I don't think there's a provision in there that allows for this kind of intersessional adjustment to be done at the request of the council. There's always the emergency provision that's available. But I don't know. I would need more time to reflect on it and talk to people about it to see if there's, any other way to do it. But that's my initial reaction. I don't know if George or Tom or anybody else who knows the process, or they have a different view of this.
My initial reaction is the same as yours. I don't know of any special provision to do something out of the ordinary, but there could be one.
And Mary Beth, your second question was? Oh, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mary Beth had two questions, and I'm not sure which one Gene and George answered. If there was a, the first is if trading results in a change in the quotas. It seems to me that I don't know if it could be done in a timely fashion, but it seems to me that that's just a change in the quota, U.S.-Canada quota, so that might not be too difficult to implement, maybe. The second question that I think she asked was, what if we wanted to change the agreed-upon harvest strategy in the TMGC, right? And I'm not sure that's actually – I'd have to go back and check. I'm not sure that's actually written – it's included in an appendix in Amendment 13, but I'm not sure that's actually specified in Amendment 13. But revising the agreed-upon harvest strategy, I think, would run into – depending what came out of it, would run into some complications with the requirement in the International Fishery Agreement Clarification Act that we still have to end overfishing. So, I mean, there's some limits on how – far we could go with revising the harvest strategy.
Well, to the chair, just to follow up, I think, though, in this particular instance, it would be worth having a discussion about what alternative strategies could be considered, when and how. I mean, if you have a stock assessment that really performs poorly, holding yourself to this strategy is very difficult, and we would have. We're still limited by the ABC that the SSC provides us here, and we would have just been in a better place for this negotiation had we been able to use that strategy. And it seemed to me that our advice was that we could not. So that's why I asked the question.
Yeah, I hadn't gotten to the second part. That's correct. I mean, we have to adhere to the track advice as far as the science that is used in the thing. And you know, that may be something that we can talk to them about. But in discussions with actually, they've been open discussions too. But in my discussions with the Canadian co-chair, one of the concerns that they have had is that our process is very much driven by the SSC, and so their sense is that we come into these meetings with our hands tied, and that you know, we have to adhere to something that in some cases they already know about. Last year we had the issue where the SSC met subsequent to the TMGC, came up with a number that was within the track range but was larger than the one that we had negotiated with the Canadians. That's why we were able to go back and ask them to open up the negotiations again.
So just to quickly follow up, it just seemed to me that our discussions about where we would be starting and ending on this were around this FREF discussion, and yet the Canadians, who seem to have agreed with this, when we talked to them afterwards, they said, well, they would have gone much higher. So they didn't feel bound by that, and yet here in the document it says this is the adopted strategy and we got to stick with it. And so, but they didn't seem like that they needed to stick with it. Is this strategy actually written up into the agreement, or is it just something that the TMGC developed through the stock assessment process along the way? If it's not, you know, an official part of the agreement, then I was just hoping perhaps we could have it on the agenda for this meeting that's coming up and have more discussions about that.
Jean?
I mean, when I was thinking about whether how we could respond quickly to a traded increase, and one possible way I think we can explore, I'm not sure it's totally doable until we explore it, is in setting the allocation is it framework 48 that we're doing it, that we set it, we set up a range perhaps that, and depending on whether we get additional attack from the Canadians later on, then that will automatically be adjusted accordingly, so that we set up the flexibility in the current action going forward that establishes the TAC with a flexibility adjuster built in at that time. And therefore, you know, we still might have to go through Federal Register notice or something, but we wouldn't have to do it as an emergency. The council wouldn't have to take action and can possibly be done quicker. So that's one thing we can explore.
John?
There's several issues here which I want to bring up, and if I get something wrong, either George or Gene will hammer me and correct it, all right? And I'm new to this, so please excuse me if I get this wrong. So in talking to my counterpart on the Canadian side, she is very willing to offer trade and transfer, and in a way that I think would be acceptable to our folks in terms of what we are trading. And to do that, the intersessional is in late February, by the way. And to do that in a way that, you know, is done on a year-to-year basis, not just this year, a year-to-year basis. And I think she's doing that on the assumption that we don't blow up the understanding, right? The key is that we don't blow up the understanding. The understanding is that the shared TAC on Yellowtail is 500, That's what is agreed to. So, you know, we have a history of going back and, you know, saying, well, no, we don't like that. We want a different number. So, you know, I think if we go back again and say we don't like that number, the idea of a trade and transfer, you know, that may be a casualty of that. That's something we have to think about. So all of these things get knitted together. Now, the other thing that the SSC talked about in the presentation, I guess it was yesterday or this morning, I can't remember, was, you know, these three numbers, 200, 400 to 500, and then this word I've never heard before, a backstop number. I don't know what backstop means. Of what was it, 1,050 or 1,150, whatever it was, whatever backstop meant. And which was last year's catch. And but the main message, which I don't think got enough underlining, Chris, was that, and which I was at the meeting, was the conclusion that everyone seemed to agree on, that yellowtail should be a bycatch fishery. That it should be a bycatch fishery. Whatever we do, whatever the council does, it should be a bycatch fishery. And so the challenge for the council is what steps do we take to make it a bycatch fishery? And that's the important work for the council. How do we make it a bycatch fishery? Now, one of the things we have to do that we, the regional office, has to make sure is the number that you set does not create overfishing. And that's what, and I think 500 meets that threshold. I don't know about the backstop number. I'm pretty sure that doesn't. So we have to judge that. So the trade and transfer can help, all right? But I don't think that's necessarily, and Canada has something to trade. It doesn't have an infinite number, right? It has something. And as many people have pointed out, they harvest almost no yellowtail, right? So they harvest almost no yellowtail. So there's a reason for them to want to trade it helps solve a piece of the problem. It's not the silver bullet, but it's a piece of the problem. But it'll work if we don't blow up the understanding.
Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. I have to say that I'm troubled by this discussion about this confusion about what mechanism would be used to facilitate some kind of trade between us and our Canadian counterparts. And I'm confused because I attended the SSC meeting in late August when Sam Rauch said, you know, we got a crisis. We're going to find every, you know, thing that we can do to mitigate this crisis. And one of the things that we're looking at is potentially a trade. So between late August, and today, nothing has been done to figure out how we're going to do that for this coming fishing year. I don't understand. I thought it was the way that Sam was talking about it. All we needed to do is decide what amount would be traded. And, you know, granted, there isn't much to be of yellowtail for them to trade back to us if we go with the 500 number, which it sounds like we're going to do, but we need every single one of those pounds. And so we can't wait until February. We have to get some kind of negotiation going with them for some simple one-time deal that we do for this year, and then you work on the longer-term strategy and how we do trades over the long term when we're in these situations. But again, I don't understand how we can be here and at this time after that SSC meeting when it sounded like, you know, oh, we're working on this and we're going to figure out how to do it, and now we don't know how to do it.
Well, he mentioned that we were doing it, and I talked with my Canadian counterpart, 3 weeks afterwards. So, yes, we are working on a trade and transfer.
If I could follow up, but if we have to now develop some mechanism that's going to be inserted in Framework 48, I mean, I just don't see how we have the time to do that. It has to be some other mechanism other than a framework that then has to go through proposed rule and final rule and all that. We need to know much sooner than that whether or not it's going to be any more fish coming to our side.
Vito?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Gigoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. Council intent, I think, would be good just to put out on the table. If the council were to say, if NOAA GC or whoever looks through to see what mechanism could actually be used, at least the council will have spoken. You're together today. If there were a motion that said, you know, I was up in Canada, and it seems to me, I think the industry there is willing to let go of whatever their scallop fishery doesn't need, is what it sounds like. And, you know, I would think something offered to say, hey, if we can get 60 ton, 70 ton of yellowtail for up to some amount of Georgia's Bank haddock, there may be an interest in that up there. And then is there any way that you could have a conference call, or is there anything in the TMGC mechanism to allow the TMGC to reconvene? I mean, if the TMGC doesn't have a unanimous yes on this, yeah, we'll accept it. Isn't that mechanism already there? We're still working within the 500 ton, so we're not changing the management strategy at all. We're still harvesting the same F reference. So it's just a matter of 60 more ton being on the U.S. side. So I don't know how rigid that agreement is, that you've got to go by the shares, the split that we have right now, so that 44% is on the U.S. side. You know, if the Canadians agree and you have the steering committee, based on a recommendation from this council, meet and say, can we have a conference call at TMGC and move that fish over? You know, you get out of the – we don't want to see the TMGC have to make those unilateral decisions, but I think if the council says it, you can do it. I know you probably have that public notice. When's the next council meeting? I mean, we're not moving fast enough here. We're going to end up with a shutdown before we start.
Just a couple of comments on that. I think the appropriate level for it, at least, is that the steering committee versus the TMGC. Our Canadian counterparts themselves were reluctant to sort of get into some of those issues without it being approved at a higher level. They also were asked about, you know, us getting some of the unused quota, and you're correct. They said yes, but we're not doing it without you giving us something in return. And the last time this council had a vote on trading, the vote was no. That was at the June meeting. So it's something that needs to be readdressed, and we went ahead at the TMGC just trying to begin a dialogue so that we could come back with something more concrete for the council to decide on.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's in our view, it's an entirely different policy discussion, and we agreed to be very cautious to have the TMGC authority change and have that negotiation of trading happen at that level. If it happens at the council level, then you have the full public process. Everyone's involved. Everyone understands the implications. So if there's a large sort of no-brainer fishery trade that could occur, for instance, Georges Bank East Haddock for Georges Bank Yellowtail, there's nothing to lose to have this council make a recommendation to the steering committee to say, float that balloon. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, at least the will of the council has been put forward from a management strategy.
Tom.
So the chair already mentioned one thing I wanted to point out, which was the council was approached and voted 1-15 not to pursue trading about a year and a half ago. And that's the only council vote on record. So it would be good if the council wants to pursue this to explain it. I think it's important to highlight some of the reasons that the vote was that way. One was because of existing workloads, which certainly haven't gotten any lighter. And the other were some concerns about the implications for trading on individual permit holders in a sector allocation system. You know, assuming we were to get 80 metric tons or 100 metric tons from the Canadians, where do they go? Do they all go to the scallop fishery? Do they all go to the groundfish fishery and get divvied up? And where does the fish that's leaving the haddock, presumably that the Canadians will want, where does that come from? If you've got a guy who has a very small amount of PSC for Eastern Georgia's Bank haddock and was planning to go fishing for it, and now we've just traded it away, and now his small piece has become an even smaller piece because we gave them 2,000 or 3,000 metric tons of haddock, you know, how does he weigh in on this process? And what does he get in return if the fish goes to a different fishery? So these are some of the complications, I think, that a year and a half ago the council was wrestling with and said, okay, we need to think about how all this stuff interacts before we pursue trading. Now, this admittedly is a different situation. When we were talking about it a year and a half ago, we were not facing quotas nearly as low as what we're talking about now. So maybe that creates additional sense of urgency. But I think it's important in highlighting that there are some things that will have to be sorted out very quickly if we're, you know, if we successfully trade with the Canadians.
Anyone else on the council? I see Mary Beth and Chairman Robbins.
Well, I think Tom raised some, you know, issues that certainly were part of that past discussion, and at that time, we didn't have numbers that were as low as they are now. I don't think the crisis, impending crisis, was the same. But I do have one question for Tom. When we talk about these allocations that will be made to sectors, those are the allocations that are in the current framework. Is that correct? So those allocations haven't actually been made.
Yes, that's correct. The allocations have not been made yet for next year. The council hasn't made decisions, for example, on what the scallop fishery allocation will be. So those have not yet been made. But, you know, I don't know how far along the sectors are on planning their activities.
So, I mean, my assumption is should any trade take place, it's going to come off the top of the total before the allocations go out to the sectors. So it would be very difficult to assess down to the individual boat level what impact, you know, these small numbers would have as far as haddock goes. We know the haddock tack in total is large, and the yellowtail total is very small. So we know that adding 60 ton, for example, to the yellowtail will have a positive impact on the overall fleet, whether you're a scallop fisherman or a groundfish fisherman. We would need to figure out how to divvy it up, and that the haddock deduction would be have little impact because we're not even taking what the haddock is now. So in light of that, I think I would like to make a motion. And my motion would be that that the council request that the U.S.-Canada Steering Committee negotiate with our Canadian counterparts for a one-time request to swap up to 200 metric ton of Georges Bank East Haddock from the U.S. 2013 share in return for at least 60 metric ton of Georges Bank Yellowtail from the Canadian 2013 share.
Could I suggest that you leave the numbers out, let us negotiate?
I would consider leaving the numbers out. I did wonder about being so specific.
Leave the numbers. Would you leave the numbers out?
Well, it doesn't really convey where we're at, but we'll leave the numbers out. So forget about the numbers, Karen.
I am going to ask that before we ask for a second that we do this either at Groundfish or under other business tomorrow. Okay?
So would you, I guess somebody would need to make a motion to table it until the Groundfish Committee?
No, it hasn't been seconded.
Oh, so I don't need to do anything. I don't need to withdraw it or anything.
Yeah, you don't. Chairman Robbins, did you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one comment. It seems that trading could provide relief in the short term, and it may play an important role in the long run also. It's obvious at this point, but, you know, it seems that the allocation model that's being applied is really too simple to meet the needs of the respective fisheries. There's no element in it. There's no dimension in that allocation model that fully reflects the importance or the value of some of these stocks where they're constraining on our fisheries, for example, such that you might have an outcome that was described earlier where the Canadians come out of it with potentially more than they need and we come out with far less than we need. The model itself is not, you know, going forward, I don't think that allocation model is going to meet the U.S. needs or allow the U.S. to protect its interests. So, I would submit that in the long run, refining that allocation model to include dimensions that fully reflect the complexity and the interrelatedness between those stocks and our respective fisheries is going to have to be part of the solution.
And thank you. I'm not sure that there's a great deal of argument about that. And as the regional administrator brought up, the effort on this is to try and keep from blowing up the agreement, because if that happens, then we still have to adhere to all of the Magnuson regulations, and we might take the whole hit on that. So we're better off, you know, with the agreement and trying to work some part of it out, but we have to be careful not to take it too far. Rich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rich Canastra. Just to refresh your memory, last year at 1,150 metric ton, we were at a crisis. At 1,150 metric ton. We're talking 500 metric ton now. We don't even know if that's going to equate to the discards. We think discard rate is going to be higher than that. And furthermore, not to rain on your parade of how we're fighting over these crumbs, which is a shame, the scallop fleet is about 60% of their trips done in Georges. And I believe, I might be wrong, but they're about 80% of the yellowtail. So, on top of this, next year, we may owe Canada back out of that 500 metric ton of what the scallopers went over this year. What a mess, and God bless you people.
Okay. Anybody on the council on this at the moment? We still have to go through the recommendations of the TMGC and vote on them. So I will do that. Karen, did you have that present? I will run through this quickly. Second slide. The negotiated TAC for Eastern Georges Bank cod for 2013 was the 600 metric tons versus the 675 in 2012. You know, they, as Loretta went over a lot of that with the two model formulations based on the different natural mortality. Given the poor Recent poor recruitment, TMGC sought to decrease fishing mortality and promote stock rebuilding. The catch level is based on more conservative adjusted projections. Next slide. 600 metric tons is the average of the two row-adjusted models for a catch level corresponding to a neutral risk of exceeding FREF. Under both adjusted projections, biomass is expected to increase more than 10%. Attack of 600 tons results in 96 for the U.S. and 504 for Canada. Next slide. Haddock attack is 10,400 metric tons versus 16,000 last year. Represents a neutral risk of exceeding FREF. Fishing mortality has been below FREF since 2007. We know all that. I'm going to go right to the next slide. The quotas you can see there. We will jump to yellowtail flounder. The TAC for Georges Bank yellowtail flounder for 2013 is 500 metric tons versus the 1150 for 2012. The retrospective bias of the benchmark model overestimates the biomass, led TMGC to consider five sensitivity analyses developed by TRAC. Next slide. A 500 metric ton catch is lower than the catch associated with a neutral risk of exceeding FREF based on unadjusted projection results. And it's expected to result in an increase in stock size and falls within the range of the sensitivity analyses provided. Attack of 500 metric tons results in a national quota of 215 metric tons for the U.S. and 285 for Canada. I believe, Karen, there was a motion that Tom had put together. I'll read it. That the Council approved the following 2013 quotas for U.S.-Canada resource sharing understanding. One, Eastern Georges Bank cod, 600 metric tons. U.S. share, 96, Canadian share, 504. Eastern Georges Bank haddock, 10,400. U.S. share, 3952. Canadian share, 6448. Three, Georges Bank yellowtail flounder, 500 metric tons, U.S. share 215 metric tons, Canadian share 285. Essentially, that would have been the same as a TMGC committee motion. I think I would feel more comfortable if I got a second for that. Dave Preble, that's my other hat. Just because we did them individually, not as one motion. So I'll open that up to discussion. David Pierce.
I appreciate the need for the motion. Do we have any idea, any understanding, anything written to describe what the impact of this particular motion would be on the fishing industry, notably the sea scallop fishery and others that are dependent upon the Georges Bank resource? It's easy to vote this through. Those are the numbers. Those are the TMGC conclusions. But what does it mean? What does it mean to the U.S. fishing industry? That would be very helpful. If we know what it means, then we would at least vote for it with an understanding as to the consequences, as opposed to innuendo and guesswork. No one's going to be comfortable, I'm sure, with the assessment of the situation as to what it means, but I'd like to see it somehow described before I would vote in favor of it.
Anyone else? Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what we do is vote this into the Framework 48, and then in Framework 48, analyze the impacts on the industry. So we need to have some numbers based on the U.S.-Canada understanding that go into the document, and then the council approves the document. So this isn't approving the numbers. That comes in November.
Okay, but still, we vote the numbers through without eventually finding out what it means. And then when we find out what it means, we have no alternative but to adopt it, regardless of what it tells us. I understand the process. I know that's the only way to proceed, but it's a very uncomfortable way to proceed.
Dave Cato.
Well, based on what Paul said, I think it would be an improvement in the language to say, to add after U.S. Canada resource sharing understanding for analysis in Framework 48, so that people clearly understand that they're being analyzed and that, you know, this isn't the final vote on these absolute numbers.
Okay. Yeah. Anyone else on the council? Drew.
Truman Cavish Fisher Survival Fund. I was strongly opposed to this motion, even with the improvement of the analysis. This motion, while putting forward what the TMGC put forward, completely ignores the debate and the entire day we all collectively spent at the SSC. Why did we have an SSC meeting on Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder if we're not even going to consider for 1 second that whole debate and the outcome of that debate? Where is that even reflected in any of this? There's no talk of the bycatch-only strategy. There's no talk of the high, you know, the United States was prohibited by its own government. The TMGC was prohibited from even bringing the higher amount to the TMGC. What is the role of the SEC here? Why do we even bother spending that day doing this? Are we just going, we have meetings and we just ignore the outcomes? And even with the addition of the language that says for analysis, what is the other option here? You know, I bring you back to the debate we had during Herring. If there are no other viable alternatives, no choices to choose from, this is actually the only quote-unquote legal alternative, then it's not legal. What if you analyze this and you're putting these numbers forward before we have any idea? Do you really know what 215 metric tons of Georges Bank is going to do to United States fishery? Do you think you might want to get a pretty good idea before you even put that forward as a possibility? 215 metric tons of yellowtail. These aren't trivial numbers. These aren't trivial fisheries we're talking about. You can't do this. Not this way. There are protections here that the industry will use to protect itself from arbitrary actions like this. This has to stop.
Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. John.
I think in answer to Dave's question, the answer is yellowtail. If I'm looking at the right chart, as of September, the amount of cod caught is 24%. So that the impact on the cod is not going to be there, obviously the impact on haddock. So really, your question boils down to, as Drew said, what's the impact on yellowtail? And Drew's question is absolutely appropriate. What do we do? How do we affect what the SSC said? How do we turn this into bycatch? How do you do what the industry has done successfully in so many ways with yellowtail avoidance? You know, how is there a way to do that? But that's what the numbers suggest we need to get to if we're going to avoid overfishing. If that's what the goal is, that's the number, that's the target we have to hit, right? Then the question becomes, how do you hit it? Because we need to hit that number if we ever want to see yellowtail get back up to the levels we want to get to. So that's the number we have to hit. And the question is, how do we do it? Now, you can say we should have an idea how we're going to do it before we set that target, or you can say we should set the target and then figure out how to do it. But that's the number we have to hit, and we have to figure out how we're going to do it. We need to do both those things, but it's yellowtail's the problem. Cod, if they were there, we'd be catching it, and we're at 24% right now, and it's September. So the impact's not going to be on cod, and obviously it's not on haddock. Although we may increase the haddock, you know, if we open those closed areas, it would be nice to see us get the number, the percentage of haddock up there. That would be a good success story. But that's a subject for another time.
Dave Casel.
Yeah, I have a little different take on that 24-ton number. I mean, you can't fish for haddock because even with the bycatch reduction nets we have, you aren't going to be able to stay under the cod or the yellowtail number. That's why we're not harvesting the haddock in the first place. You can't do it. The things all swim together. And that's the crux of this entire problem. Once again, you're back at the single species level, putting up numbers that are so low for a couple of species that you guarantee you'll never get the one that's abundant. I don't know how much longer we have to go on before we admit this entire thing has just failed. I'm happy to vote this through. I'll use as a reference that the cod number is 6 tons higher than the red hake quota for all of the northern area. You know, so you want to talk about another absurd number? The northern red hake is absolutely, totally absurd. It was caught by 12 boats in Area 1 in not even fishing for them. It's a bycatch fish in something like, 4 weeks? You know, you have a lot more boats fish on George's Bank than you have fish for whiting in Area 1. And, you know, at some point you have to admit that some of these numbers are simply don't even jive remotely with reality. And that is exactly what you're seeing right here. These numbers don't jive with what everybody in the audience has been telling you for weeks about yellowtail. They don't jive at all. So I'm happy to put this forward and get it analyzed, and I'm quite sure what the analysis is going to tell you. This is going to lead to a shutdown of both the groundfish and the scallop fisheries on George's Bank. And then maybe, just maybe, somebody might fix the problem. Once you've shut down billions of dollars worth of fisheries, maybe then somebody will admit that this system doesn't work the way it's supposed to. And maybe we'll fix it. But right now, these are the numbers that have been put forward by what is termed the best available science. And as near as I can tell, you don't have a choice. So as Drew said, they'll do what they have to do. And I think what they have to do is blow up Magnuson. And that's probably what's going to occur out of this. So I think everybody ought to go into it with their eyes wide open. And so what's happened here as we finally reached the illogical conclusion of single species management.
Dave Pierce.
Yeah, I certainly hear David Gethel loud and clear, and I'm listening to the audience, and I've got my own problems with the George's Bank yellowtail flounder assessment. But I have to set them aside for a while because I won't make any headway with resolving those problems here today. But in light of the motion before us now, and in light of the fact that we do have, after a great deal of discussion by the SSC, a suggestion from them, an option from them regarding the 1,150 metric ton backstop ABC, I'd make a motion to amend. And the motion would be to add the following sentence to the motion on the board. And it would be, the SSC recommended ABC of 1150 metric tons as a bycatch fishery also should be included in the Framework 48 analysis. It's a number we have before us provided by the SSC. Let's at least have it analyzed to see what it means, compare it with the consequences of the other yellowtail flounder option up there. So at least we'll have a better idea as to what it implies. So I'd like that number included. So that's the motion to amend the SSC recommended ABC of 1150 metric tons of the bycatch fishery also should be included in the framework 48 analysis. Yes, that's it.
So seconded by Mary Beth. Tom.
I spoke to it a little bit earlier under the SSC discussion. I guess I don't disagree with evaluating this, but the idea that we don't have a bycatch fishery right now, we have this ABC right now. I don't understand. Some people have started using the term bycatch fishery as though it's a new tool that we haven't stumbled across before. The ground fish, we mentioned where the sectors are right now. Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder, we've caught 11% of it right now. The ground fish is using yellowtail as a bycatch. The scallopers are using yellowtail. They've developed tools to avoid yellowtail. They're using it as a bycatch right now. There's no, in my mind, there's no one out directing on Georgia's Bank yellowtail right now. Maybe there's someone out there, but they're pretty foolish to do it. And I don't think that, while we can analyze this, I don't think there's a magical bycatch definition somewhere that fundamentally changes how we approach this. People are trying to avoid this stock. The number and the economics of going fishing dictates whether it's a bycatch stock or not, not us. I mean, how much yellowtail you can avoid or how much scallops you can catch per pound yellowtail, that's what dictates the bycatch nature of that stock. Same on the groundfish side. So I don't know, you know, I'm happy to support the analysis of this backstop ABC, another word that we've sort of stumbled across recently, but I don't really understand what a bycatch fishery means in terms of a change in our management strategy, certainly on the groundfish side.
Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This motion, along with other motions at the Groundfish Committee, adds an awful lot of work to Framework 48 that was already barely able to be ready for the November Council meeting. So I'd like to put the service on notice that if, in fact, we're late and not submitting in November and have to go to December, January, February, whatever we have to do to get this right, and we don't have the right documentation, that they are prepared to streamline the review process and do everything they can to get it in place May 1st or early, May 1st for the groundfish, or May 1st for Framework 48. This is getting very complicated.
Anyone else on the council? Call the question. All those in favor of the amended motion? Sixteen in favor. Oppose. Abstention. 16-01. The motion carries. Unless there is other business on that right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we done with this item? Because I just had one last thing before we break for the day.
Yes, we are done with this item.
I just wanted to mention that, you know, we discussed earlier under scallops the two motions that we deferred till tomorrow, but we do have some people here in the industry who thought we would take them up today and will not be here tomorrow. So I hope that you might, I know it's late, but just allow them to make some comments on priorities and the habitat motion that was contained in the scallop meeting summary.
Tom.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman, you have to need to vote again.
Right.
I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely. Okay, we're on the main motion as amended. All those in favor? Seventeen. Motion carries. I'm sorry. Tom, you had something.
Well, I could hold this off to tomorrow, but this creates some issues for the framework document. We're already supposed to analyze a range of catches for the two cod stocks and white hake because those benchmark assessments are going to be completed later. And now we're talking about analyzing a range of catches for Georges Bank yellowtail flounder without really knowing how those catches are going to be distributed if they're allowed. We don't yet know what the scallop fishery amounts will be and what will go to the groundfish fishery. And this is going to make it very difficult to generate meaningful economic analyses that capture all the possible interactions between these different effects. The other thing that's going to be difficult to analyze, quite bluntly, is we had a little bit of a discussion this morning about the overfishing limit for Georges Bank yellowtail flounder during the SSC report. And I, frankly, am at a loss for how we're going to argue that 1,150 tons does not exceed the overfishing limit.
John?
I just point out that the groundfish fleet to date has harvested 10% of the yellowtail limit. So they're doing a good job avoiding right now. I don't know what the number is for the scallop fleet, but the groundfish is doing a great job.
Okay. Are there somebody wanted to make some comments concerning the motion of including?
Just to refresh everybody's memory, there were two motions that we'll take up tomorrow that were came forth from the scallop committee. One is relative to habitat, the habitat omnibus amendment, and I think there's some people who would like to speak to that. And then the other motion was under priority.